Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Stitch Duran, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show. I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bet.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Around the world once again. This is Bob Carson of Carson's Corner. Pleased to be with you here this Thursday evening. It is January 26, 2017, right here on Blog Talk Radio and everywhere else in the world. We're supposed to have Anthony for the Freight Train Hamilton. He's supposed to be calling in. He should have called in. We confirmed with him yesterday that he would be calling into the program, and we haven't heard from him, so hopefully he'll be joining us very, very soon. Want to talk to him. Actually, I've wanted to talk to Anthony since he was the MFC heavyweight champion. He won the championship at MFC with the highlight reel knockout of Smolino Rama. And, you know, the folks over at MFC, Mark Pavlich and their media director, Scott Zur, have been very, very media friendly to me in particular, really over the last, I would say, 8 or 9 years before. Maybe less than that, maybe 6 or 7 years before Mark Pavlich sold the MFC. And we were the first show, I believe, to report that. Mark Pavlich gave us the exclusive interview announcing his plans to sell one of the greatest Canadian mixed martial art promotions and one of the greatest promoters of the game, Mark Pavlich, deciding to basically give it up. And that was an exclusive news scoop right here on Carson's Corner, and I believe that Mark has some sort of management company now. The firm management, I was looking at them on Twitter the other day. It's good to see the Pav, hopefully, getting back into mixed martial arts and fighter management. Very, very important. He's a great guy, and we always loved having him on the show. And Anthony Hamilton is one of the few MFC fighters that we never really got a chance to interview, and hopefully we'll be able to interview him as he calls in. You know, journeyman heavyweight, exciting fighter. You know, he's a guy that when he went to college, he competed in two contact sports, football and wrestling. And he's someone that really, if you look at his fights, if he goes past the first round, there's a really, really good chance he wins those fights. All around, very, very nice guy, and we're hoping to get him on the program here on Carson's Corner in the next few moments or so. If you want to give me a call, you can at 347-326-9749. That is 347-326-9749. We have a lot to talk about here. A lot has happened since our last show with Ricardo Llamas. Big thanks again to Ricardo Llamas. Nothing really has come out as far as his next matchup. But again, he's expected to take on Frankie Edgar after Frankie recovers from his groin surgery. And that should take place sometime in the spring. Unlike another fighter, Michael Bisping, who now is having surgery on his knee, has elected to take time off and get knee surgery rather than defend his title. And I want to talk about this because I posted a doozy of a thread on the Underground Forum. And as is expected, I really got flamed by a lot of people. Nothing new on the Underground Forum. You know, for years, you get used to it. You almost get callous to it. You know, when people just insult you and talk about this and the other thing, that's fine. They call you every name in the book. I mean, that's, you know, that's why we love the Underground Forum. But I got to tell you, more and more people now are coming to the realization that Michael Bisping just doesn't want to fight. He doesn't, you know, there was a time, and you can't take anything away from his career. He's had a great career. He's going to be in the UFC Hall of Fame. He's fought any and all comers. There's no question about that. But let's be honest. I mean, how in the world can you say after he won his title, after knocking out Luke Rockhold, coming off of a movie set, knocking out Luke Rockhold, okay, in was it the first round of their rematch on 2 or 3 weeks' notice, getting that belt, how in the world can anyone say that Michael Bisping has been willing to defend his title? He gets a hand-picked opponent in Dan Henderson. I don't care what anybody says. The UFC didn't come up to him and ask for Dan Henderson, because Bisping actually said that, you know, he wanted to fight Dan Henderson. He's always said that. He said that for a while. He said that even before he won the title versus Luke Rockhold, that he wanted to fight Bisping. He wanted to fight Henderson. He wanted to avenge that loss. And so nobody's getting fooled with that. Nobody believes that. He beats Henderson in a very, very controversial decision. A lot of people didn't feel he won that fight. You look at his face afterwards, and you look at Dan Henderson's face. Bisping had to go to the hospital. Dan Henderson was doing interviews. Bisping didn't look like the winner of that fight. And in the eyes of many fans, he wasn't the winner of this fight. Then he says afterwards, the UFC wanted him to fight before the first of the year. He said, okay, now it's too short in between fights. I can't do it. You know, it's just too much. And the UFC said, okay, how about sometime in the new year? They said, then Bisping says, no, I want to fight in the springtime. I want to spend the holiday season with my family. I want to fight in the springtime. That'll give me enough time to prepare, not enough time to have a full training camp to prepare for Yoel Romero. And sure enough, the UFC accommodates him. Now he says, oh, I want to have knee surgery. I want to take some time off, and I want to fight in May. That's when I'll come back. And now he's not even sure if he wants to fight Yoel Romero. He didn't come out and explicitly say that he doesn't want to fight Yoel Romero. But you know what? He doesn't want to fight Yoel Romero because he wants the money fight, the quote money fight, as if Michael Bisping is this huge draw like Conor McGregor is, like Michael Bisping is going to be able to get millions and millions of people that are going to order his pay-per-views. It's not going to happen. And so what happens is, nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody knows who he's going to fight next, and nobody knows when he's going to fight next. And you've got a UFC belt now in a real, real, you know, a good, strong division. You've got people like Yoel Romero, again, who beat Jacare. Whatever you thought of that fight, I thought Jacare may have won that fight, but Yoel Romero gets a decision. He's beaten Chris Weidman, former champion, knocked him out in very, very convincing fashion in the third round. And he should get a title shot. There's no question about that. But now, you know, Michael Bisping, who understands that his next fight is most likely going to be his last fight. I mean, he's talked about retirement very, 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 very frequently. He said that, you know, he's 38 years old. He's going to be turning 38 years old soon. He's had that eye surgery. Okay, he understands that he's not going to be fighting for a long time, and he understands that his next fight is most likely going to be his last fight. So what is he doing? He's essentially depriving the fans of what they want to see. He's depriving the division of operating, because when you have a champion that doesn't defend his title and is reluctant to defend his title, as I believe he is, then the fans suffer, the division suffer, fighters grow restless, and it all becomes meaningless in the end. And the UFC doesn't owe him anything. What does the UFC owe Michael Bisping? I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. You know, I mean, you know, he's fought. Yeah, he's taken some short notice fights and whatnot. But they've given him a gift. You know, many of his fights that he's won, you know, Anderson Silva, another controversial decision victory, which a lot of people felt he lost after, you know, getting knocked out after it was a round two. Dan Henderson, no question he won the Luke Rockhold fight, but you can make an argument that, hey, listen, you know, it was one of those times where he threw a punch, he meant to land it, he landed it, but would that punch have landed, you know, in nine fights out of 10? I don't know. Okay. And you know, they really, really don't owe him anything. And now you're going to have him sitting out, and God knows when he's going to be back. I mean, you know, he knows damn well in his heart that he doesn't want to fight Yoel Romero, because he knows that even though he may have a good style, and you listen to his boxing coach, Jason Perillo, talk about how, you know, he's got a good style and they could strategize to beat him, and with Michael Bisping's cardio, and they could stay away from Yoel Romero. The likelihood that he's going to be able to stay away from the soldier of God for five rounds and not get whacked, it's not going to happen. I mean, I think he'll get knocked out, and I think Yoel Romero will become the champion. But you can't argue at this point that he wants to fight Yoel Romero. He wants to take an easier fight. Maybe he wants to fight Nick Diaz, which would be an absolute disgrace if that happens. Nick Diaz, who hasn't fought in 4 or 5 years, then the title means absolutely nothing if he fights Nick Diaz. Now, maybe he wants to fight a smaller guy in George St. Pierre. Okay, George St. Pierre, who supposedly signed the contract with the UFC, and is you know, his future is uncertain. You know, they don't know what's going to happen. But you know, I mean, this is just absolutely ridiculous. He has a responsibility to defend his title, and the UFC has to start playing hardball with a lot of these fighters that have championships, you know, with the exception of Conor McGregor. They really can't do anything with Conor McGregor, but you know, some of these other fighters who are, you know, reluctant to defend their title. And you know, he's reluctant because he says things that just he doesn't follow through on. You know, says that he's going to fight UL in the springtime, then he elects to get knee surgery. You know how many fighters are fighting injured right now? You know how many fighters are fighting, you know, instead of getting surgery, because that's the way the fight game is? That's, you know, what they have to put themselves through? I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, you know, and people throw out the example of Conor McGregor. Oh, Conor McGregor, you know, when he won the championship from Jose Aldo, he didn't fight Aldo for quite some time. Well, you know what? There's no doubt, I don't think in anybody's mind, that Conor McGregor wants to fight you know, people that he shouldn't beat and champions of other divisions. I mean, yeah, I mean, Nate Diaz isn't the best you know, welterweight out there, but he lost to Nate Diaz, and he wanted to fight Nate Diaz at 170, and he fights him at 170 again, and he wins. That's not somebody that doesn't want to fight. He goes in there and fights Eddie Alvarez, and nobody was picking Eddie Alvarez to beat Conor McGregor, and Conor McGregor made it look like a mismatch. You know, now the only question of who is he going to fight? Is he going to fight Woodley? You know, is he going to fight? There's just he's proven himself to be a much, much higher caliber fighter than Michael Bisping, and more importantly, a much, much higher draw than Michael Bisping. So, you know, even if he was not willing to fight some fighters at a particular division, you have to, you can't really question Conor McGregor's willingness to fight anybody. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous, you know. And then, you know, some other people point out, oh, there have been other champions that have waited for a long time before they faced anybody, and there's been a long time in between title defenses. And to me, it just doesn't matter. It's just you can't have somebody hold on to the belt that doesn't want to defend it and wants to selectively defend it whenever he feels like it. It's just not right. It's not good for the sport. And the UFC, almost with Conor, has set a dangerous precedent where fighters can do this now. You know, you look at someone like Tyron Woodley, and Tyron Woodley is someone that I didn't like initially, but you know what? I respect Tyron Woodley because he didn't want to fight Stephen Thompson. He wanted the money fight, was talking about Nick Diaz, was talking about George St. Pierre, talking about, you know, everybody other than, you know, the top contenders in his division. But now, you know, he fights Stephen Thompson. As far as I'm concerned, he beats Stephen Thompson, okay, nearly finishes Stephen Thompson. And then he's forced to fight again. And he'll fight again. He'll fight Thompson again, and he'll beat Thompson decisively. And then what's going to happen? You know, I mean, Woodley has not gotten the preferential treatment that Michael Bisping has got. And that, like I said on the forum, the UFC likes Michael Bisping. There's no question about that. He's part of, quote, the Fox family out there. You know, he's on Fox Sports 1, right? He's chummy with Dana White and all the Hollywood elites, and that's fine. That's it. But I mean, this is just a mockery. People are really questioning his legitimacy. Certainly, his legitimacy as a champion. You know, you can't question his legitimacy as a fighter. But then again, you know, in the UFC, in the mixed martial arts, fighters depreciate. I mean, I hate to say it. I wish it were another way. But the reality of the market is that, you know, 6 months, a year, might as well be 6 years, might as well be 10 years, you know, 15 years. So you have a guy like Michael Bisping or any fighter that doesn't fight, okay, or whatever the circumstances is, they become obsolete very, very quickly. And it's very, very hard to get that mental focus back. And it's an uphill battle. And so, you know, in another 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, 6 months, we could be talking about a whole different group of people that are in these fighters that are in these divisions that are relevant, more relevant to the fighters that are there now. This is just very, very frustrating to me. We're going to be deprived of a champion defending his title. And also, too, I'm getting sick, and I know a lot of the fans are, a lot of the MMA fans are, not the casual fans, but a lot of the MMA fans are getting sick of these interim titles that almost cheapen the actual titles. You know, Anthony, okay. Anthony Hamilton just texted me. I'm just texting him while I'm on the the phone now. Let me see if he, yeah. Okay, I'm just texting him the phone number now. And I actually did before, actually. So, yeah. But anyway, you know, fans are getting tired of this. The UFC and the new company, they want to have interim titles. They want to have the titles on so that they can promote each fight as a title fight. But for the most part, it's really, really just cheapening the divisions and just making it more frustrating for the fans out there. We don't need more interim titles. We need champions to defend their titles against top contenders, not the, quote, money fights out there. But you know what? We may see more money fights. We may see just more what Scott Coker would call fun fights, although it's not quite as bad as Bellator's fights are. But we may start to see that in the UFC as it becomes more and more difficult for, you know, the company that bought the UFC, WMEIMG, to repay back the loan and to you know, make money for their shareholders. And, you know, you've got a lot of different variables. And as I've said before, 2017 is not shaping up to be a good year for the UFC in terms of pay-per-views, in terms of stars, in terms of, you know, TV. They're doing okay. The TV ratings are doing okay, which is what I'm going to talk about in just a little while with Bellator. But they have their challenges, and who knows what's going to happen if the ownership gets buyer's remorse and then says, you know what, we want out of this, okay? We bought the UFC for an inflated price. There's too many variables in this game, in this sport, and it's just too much of a risk for us. Did you guys see Bellator 170? I did, of course. I made it my mission to watch Bellator 170, and I got to tell you, I was quite impressed with some of the fights on the card, particularly Paul Daly and Brennan Ward. And it was really depressing because when I was on the conference call, the press conference call, nobody could pronounce Brennan Ward's name. They all called him Brandon Ward, but it's Brennan Ward, not Brandon Ward. I knew that Paul Daly was going to win that fight. I knew it was just a matter of time. But I got to tell you, though, Brennan Ward looked like he was winning that fight. He looked like he was winning up until that knee, that real devastating knee that Paul Daly landed that really ended the fight very, very abruptly and, of course, violently. So it was a really good effort, and Brennan looked like he was mixing his strikes and mixing his takedowns very, very well, but he just got caught, and that's what was expected. And that fight, I posted this on the Underground Forum. I got a press release from the folks over at Spike TV. They like me over at Spike TV, actually. Bellator, I'm not convinced, likes me. Although, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, it doesn't really matter to them because Bellator banned me a couple of years ago from covering their events after I released the results from their disastrous Fightmaster series. I got the results and I released it and they got pissed. But then a couple folks over at Spike TV vouched for me and they got me in, so I'm able to cover them. And David Schwartz and others, they've always been very, very nice, very, very, very professional, very respectful to me because I'll cover events and they'll always, you know, say hello to me and you know, they'll give me decent access and whatnot. Bellator, I would say overall is more friendly to media. I mean, you know, there's less media covering Bellator. I understand that. The UFC is just an absolute disaster. I mean, I couldn't get into a UFC if I tried, nor would I really want to. But you know, Bellator is really, really they've opened their arms to welcome the media out there. And I posted something on the Underground that we're going to talk about the Tito Ortiz and Chael Sonnen fight because there's just so much ridiculousness surrounding that. But you've got 1.5 million, actually 2 million viewers tuned in for Daly versus Ward, which is really, really good. You know, that shows you that people at the end of the day want to see a knockdown, drag out brawl. I don't say brawl, but fight between two stand-up fighters. So that's what you had with Paul Daly and Brennan Ward. And I got to tell you, Paul Daly is an intimidating guy. He really is. I heard him do an interview today, and I actually saw him when I covered Bellator 164, the title fight between what's his name, McGeary and Phil Davis, and he's like kind of a thug. You know, it reminds me of this movie I saw. It's called Eden Lake. If you get a chance, you know, YouTube rents these movies, and you can, you know, for like $1, $2, $3, or sometimes they have new releases that are $14, $15, but you could rent these movies off of YouTube. And I don't have a television, and so all my, if I watch a movie, it's through Netflix or through YouTube. And I watched this movie. It's called Eden Lake. It's released, I think, back in 2008 or 2009. And I'm one of these guys that I like disturbing films. I like anything by Larry Clark or you know, one of these real disturbing films. There's so many. I don't really like the snuff films, although I have seen a few of these snuff films, you know. But either Funny Games. I like Ken Park and anything that really kind of rattles my mind a little bit. You know what I mean? And this is a movie about a kind of an upscale couple that they go to this lake, this like abandoned lake, and they meet these group of hoodlums, really, really wild, crazy hoodlums in Britain there. And they call them the townies. You know, they call them like a person who lives in a town who, you know, it's almost like here in New Jersey, they call the people that it's kind of a racist term, but they call the people that live in the southern tip of New Jersey Pineys, you know, because they're kind of they have their own culture and whatnot. And townies are people that live in England that are, you know, kind of working class, kind of a little bit rough around the edges, kind of thuggish a little bit. That's what Paul Daly is. I'm telling you, Paul Daly would have fit in well in this movie. If Paul Daly wanted to have an acting career, and I'm sure he's probably done some movies, he would really, really do well in Eden Lake 2, because he actually is, you know, for a British guy, a very intimidating guy. And I like, you know, British accents. Like, for me, it's hard to listen to someone with a British accent and get intimidated, because it's actually a very sophisticated accent, and people really all across the world desire to sound British. You know, look at some of our celebrities here, like Madonna and whatnot. But it's he's kind of a crazy guy. He was arrested, Paul Daly, for a bar fight. I mean, just fill in the blank. You know, I mean, it's not surprising. But, you know, I'm sure he has his decent side. I'm sure he's an okay guy. You know, he's been around the sport a long time, and he's in his early 30s, and he'll probably be fighting for a long time, because he doesn't seem to be taking that much damage. But wanted to see that, you know, and I really, really commend those two for fighting the way they did. And it was a great, great fight for Scott Coker to put on the card. Now, for the Tito Ortiz-Chael Sonnen fight, when I had an opportunity to ask Chael Sonnen on the press conference call about ring rust, and these guys do a lot of media interviews, and that's one of the things about MMA media now. I don't know if you've noticed, but MMA media is really, really kind of just all about interviews. It's an interview-driven business now. You know, it's not commentary. It's all about interviews. How many fighters can you get? Can you get, you know, 3-4 fighters a show? And that's it. And now, to me, I like interviewing guys and girls when I can, believe me, just as much as the next person. Believe me, I that's what we do best here on Carson's Corner. We have the best interviews on the planet, no question about that. Most comprehensive interviews out there. But fighter interviews, interviewing fighters are just, it's not really compelling radio. You know, I mean, it has its limits in terms of being entertaining. You know, I mean, yeah, you can have entertaining fighters and you can have entertaining interviews, but for the most part, it's more informational. You know, and then you get these sites that, and I do the same thing, believe me. I'm not saying I'm above the fray here. But you get these sites that'll, you know, take a couple clips from the interviews and make the headlines, and boom, that's it. And it goes out there, and it's just all this kind of, you know, just this viral world in which we live in. But there really really isn't any commentary, and it's kind of unfortunate. So when you listen to Chael Sonnen, and you listen to like Tito and these guys that are doing the press tour, they tend to answer the questions the same way, because it's not that they have talking points in their head. It's that they get asked the same question in different variations by almost every host out there. And so Chael said, you know, when I asked him about ring rust, he said, you know, I don't know. It could be a factor. He said, I haven't wrestled. I haven't been off for more than 7 weeks. I used to wrestle all the time as a kid. I'm disappointed that they only have 2 or 3 MMA matches throughout the year. And, you know, I don't know. You know, Tito has been more familiar with the Bellator cage. Tito's been a little bit more active over the course of the last couple of years. And I got to tell you, from the moment he walked out there, it just looked like he wasn't prepared. You know, he looked flabby. He didn't look in shape. He didn't look into it. He just looked out of it. And, you know, sure enough, Tito gets him. And the moment I posted on the Underground about Tito or Chael losing his stock, and what I meant by that is Chael, his value is dropping, or his value, his intrigue. You know, are people going to believe this, you know, gangster and this whole bad guy routine, this whole pro wrestling shtick? Are they going to want to see a guy that really continually loses? Now, I realize that Chael can fight, and he is fighting at a lower weight class, you know, fight at 185 or whatever the case is, but you know, I thought his stock would drop. I thought he would really get hurt from this. And then a few days after that, he gets fired from this ridiculous Celebrity Apprentice. I don't watch that. I haven't watched any TV shows going back. I can't even remember the last TV show I watched. I just don't watch them. And then they had to cancel a Submission 3 Underground, you know, for contractual reasons and so on and so forth. And so, the second I posted on the Underground, everybody was saying, oh, this is a fix. He took a dive, this and that. And believe me, I've called certain fights dives and fix before. And I always tend to get lambasted on the forums for it. I don't have a problem doing it, but I noticed with this fight, there was just more people, more, posters calling this a fixed fight than usual. And then you get guys, you've get, you know, people like Dan Hardy, who's a UFC commentator, and you get Joe Rogan calling this fixed fights, a fixed fight, this, that. And to me, it didn't look fixed at all. I mean, I don't see how anybody could say that. What Chael, although he denies this, what Chael tapped out to was a neck crank. It was a catch wrestling neck crank that Tito used with the gable grip to twist Chael's neck. And Tito was very, very strong in that position. You know how I know that? Because Tito Ortiz, I went to a Tito Ortiz seminar that he showed up 17 hours late for before he dropped Evan Tanner on his head and he won the championship back in, was it 2000? I mean, just back in the dark ages there. And Tito, you know, he knows that position very well. He can, you know, if he gets you in that position very early in the fight, then guess what? Boom. It's a done deal. And, you know, that's what Tito does. If you look at his submissions, typically as of late, you know, Ryan Bader and Chael Sonnen, they're very early in the fight. You know, they come off of bad shots from his opponent. You know, and he's quick. He knows guillotine. You know, he knows submissions. He has a very underrated submission game. There's no question about it. And I knew that it was over for Chael. I knew that he was stuck in a bad position, and that's it. You know, he lost. It was humiliating for him. But to have, you know, people like Rogan or people like Dan Hardy, you know, it's just ridiculous. It's reactionary. It's unfortunate, you know. And they would never say that if it was a UFC fight. Would you hear Joe Rogan say that? Would you hear Bellator or would you hear Dan Hardy, whatever, say that about a UFC fight that they thought it was fixed, or tweet that or whatever? No, I mean, Dana White would destroy them. They'd be, you know, who knows what would happen to them. And so I just thought that was ridiculous. I was one of the few people on the forum that said, no, this fight wasn't fixed. This fight was legit. And, you know, Chael just lost. Chael looked horrible. Tito trained, and Tito reaped the benefits of him training. Now, this fight actually peaked at 2.2 million viewers. Okay, the folks over at Bellator, who sent me a very, very nice press release there, they broke it down about the reaction on social media and how this fight, Bellator 170, drew a lot of viewers, second most viewers on Bellator.com, their app. Bellator 170 was the number one trending topic on Twitter, and Bellator MMA trended one on Google Trends. So, you know, Bellator has something going here, and as you get more and more fighters that are going to test their free agency and that are going to really, you know, take advantage of Bellator, it's only going to be uphill here or downhill here for Bellator. Now, the thing that was really depressing about 170 was the fighter payouts. I mean, it was just abysmal. And that's something we got to really acknowledge, because low fighter pay is not just a UFC phenomenon. Although the UFC makes the most revenue, the UFC siphons the most revenue from its fighters, and it's only going to get worse for UFC fighters out there. I mean, Bellator, you have an opportunity to make up, you know, with sponsorships and all that stuff, but the Bellator payouts were absolutely depressing. Now, I'm just going off the top of my head here, because that's what we do here on Carson's Corner. There isn't too much I don't know here, okay? There's no question about that. But I think Tito Ortiz got $300,000. That's what Tito Ortiz's fight purse was. And that's not a lot of money. I mean, let's be honest. This Tito's been in the sport for 20 years. Tito's a draw. Okay, you know, the guy, you can't question that. Anytime the guy fights, a lot of people are going to tune in. He's done a lot for the sport, and I don't think he's at the level of Conor McGregor, as Tito says he is. I don't think he's at it, but nonetheless, I mean, you got to give the guy his credit. And then, you know, you've got taxes, and you've got, I'm sure Tito's got overhead but you get the point. Chael Sonnen, if I'm not mistaken, only made $50,000 for that fight. That is just, and then it just goes down from there. You know, if you got Tito making $300,000 for that fight, then what are all the other guys making? You know, with no win bonuses, I don't know what Chael was thinking. I mean, I guess he looks at it from a marketing standpoint. You know, it keeps his name out there. It keeps people, you know, interested. There was a lot of trash talk and a lot of hype, you know, coming into this fight. You know, Bellator played the hype machine very, very well. And as I said, you know, there was a lot of interest that was generated on Bellator.com and Google and Twitter.com. But I just, from a monetary standpoint, I mean, that's just, you know, that's $50,000. You know, it's just not a lot of money. I mean, really, for someone that's fighting in the main event and for, you know, someone that's essentially fighting in front of 2.2 million people, it's really not. And then it just gets more and more depressing going down the card. I mean, looking at the fighter payouts there, I believe Paul Daly made $50,000, and Brennan Ward made the same. Hasaki Kato, $30,000. Halleck Gracie, $33,000. Although they probably shouldn't have paid Halleck Gracie anything. They probably should have just cut in half his for that ridiculous performance there, if you want to call it a performance. I mean, come on. You're going to fight, you're going to fight. You sign up, you take the fight, you fight. I mean, Jesus. I know a thing or two about a thing or two when it comes to not fighting. I really do. But, I mean, that is just absolutely – that was offensive, that fight. It really was. And then it just goes down from there. So low fighter pay is not just a UFC phenomenon, even though the UFC is the most egregious company out there when it comes to paying their fighters what they're worth. And, you know, we're going to have to keep an eye on this. We really are. I got invited to the – there's going to be a press conference next Tuesday at Madison Square Garden for the Klitschko-Joshua fight. And this is not going to be in the United States. I think I want to say this is going to be in England because there's 80,000 tickets already sold. But it should be interesting because I've never really been to a boxing, you know, press conference. And the great one, Eddie Goldman, invited me. He invited a bunch of different people. I don't know if he's going to be able to if he's going to announce something. But it's going to be good to really at least cover this. Maybe we'll get some questions in there for some fighters. Maybe we'll talk to Eddie himself. Maybe we'll play some audio from the great Eddie Goldman here on Carson's Corner. I don't know, but I'm going to make it up to Tuesday, make it up to Madison Square Garden, which is really not too far from where I'm at here. Just a hop, skip, and a jump to Madison Square Garden. We're going to take a brief time out here on Carson's Corner. We come back, we'll talk more UFC. I want to talk about Ronda Rousey becoming a social justice warrior now. You'll hear my take on that. We'll talk about some other things. And Anthony Hamilton should be calling in. We're trying to get him to call in here on Carson's Corner. So just keep it right here. If you want to give me a call, you can at 347-326-9749.
Many questions we have as we grow. It's hard to find answers to what we don't know. But sometimes there's someone to whom we can turn to teach us life lessons, help us to learn just what's important and what matters most. Much more than our teacher, and we call them coach. Right there to guide us when we need a hand. They reach deep inside us and help us to stand. To lead by example in words and in deeds, and show us the courage we need to succeed. And I stand before you proud to boast. I'm one of the many who's learned from the coast to never surrender your hopes or your that you travel, the choices you make, the load that you carry, the chances you take. We raise our glasses and offer this toast to one who will always be known.
Welcome back here at the Carson's Corner. I'm your host, Bob Carson. Pleased to be with you here, and hopefully sometime soon we will be speaking to Anthony Hamilton. We invited him to call, and he said he was going to call, and I just heard from him a while back via text, and we're going to try to connect with him here on the air on Carson's Corner. All right, so Ronda Rousey is still in the news. You know, isn't it amazing that all anybody can still talk about really is Ronda Rousey? There's so much intrigue about her. She really is a headline, you know, getter or whatever. She's someone that you put her in a story and people will clickbait or whatever the hell it is. Clickbait is, I don't know. But she's just a very, very popular figure. Even she lost, and even the new fight sport, the new Fight Sport page refers to her as a humiliated UFC champion. And to a certain extent, she was. She was humiliated, I think. I guess, you know, she was humiliated against, Holly Holm. After she lost to Holly Holm, just went into a retreat, didn't even really mention Holly Holm's name. It's like, it's as if, you know, Holly Holm has been erased. It's as if Ronda has. I saw this movie Split yesterday. You guys probably heard about it. It's actually getting a lot of press, and it got favorable reviews from some of these websites like Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's got 7.6 out of 10 or something like that. It was good. I mean, there's nothing to write home about. I'm not going to tell you it was amazing. You know, like I said earlier in the film, in the show, I like disturbing films, so this movie was right up my alley. And James McVoy did a good job. He was a good villain. He played a villain that has 23 personalities, and he kidnaps these girls. And, you know, something happened to him traumatically in his life to make him have all these personalities. And, you know, the brain reacts to defend itself, and it's really – There are some interesting issues that were brought up in this movie about personalities and is a legit mental disorder, and can personalities give people human strengths and the ability to see and all these different things that would not be possible under their real personality. And, you know, there's a big backlash to this film. A lot of people are, oh, it's offensive. Rob Dyke did a video about the backlash to this movie. It's just absurd. But, you know, I was thinking about this because you look at Ronda Rousey, and it's almost as if she has different personalities. You know, it's like she has different sides to her personality, I guess, and she loses. It was a very traumatic experience for her losing to Holly. And then she comes and she just gets obliterated and embarrassed by Amanda. And, you know, it looks like she's done fighting, although I posted again on the Underground that she really should be fighting Sarah McMahon. That should be her next fight. It's that'd be a perfect fight for her. But who knows? You know, but, you know, this is how she's reacted to getting hit. And yeah, you could see this. It, you know, it's more so with female fighters than male fighters. And we're going to talk about Ronda's foray into social justice, but I just want to make this one point here. When female fighters get hit, like Amanda, you could see like this their soul. You could almost see them getting so emotionally traumatized in their face. You know, that kick, that punch when you know, there was actually when Amanda fought Misha, and there was one punch that Misha or that Amanda landed, and you just look at Misha's face, and she was just so like emotionally traumatized from being punched like that, that you could just tell like that it's all drained from their bodies. All it's they're done, and I don't blame them. I mean, I like I said, I did MMA before. And, you know, I got hit a few times, and it's, look, it's not for me. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to put myself through that and whatnot. And I'd rather be a fat slob and talk about it. But in any event, it's just different with female fighters. You know, it's different with female fighters that don't have a striking background and can be successful in MMA using aspects of their game other than striking. Okay, developing areas of their game other than striking, which is what Ronda has done, which is what Ronda, you know, which is how she got successful. And what, you know, Mike Tyson obliterating people, you know, knocking people out in 90 seconds. Ronda submitting, you know, the emotionally vulnerable Katsangano in 14 seconds. I'm sorry, I had to throw that in there. But now the intrigue is gone and people always remember her, but they're just, it's they're not going to, you know, her time is past. It's done. As I said earlier, fighters depreciate, and they depreciate, you know, very quickly in this game. And so, you know, Ronda ends up really losing, and now she's going to become a social justice activist and rally around certain causes that are near and dear to her heart. Now, I will say this, and people are questioning her authenticity here. They're questioning whether or not she really cares and she's just doing this for headlines and she's really helping out the Native American community that is protesting this pipeline. I will say, I think the answer to that question is yes, and the reason why is because if you look at Ronda's mother's posts, Ronda's mother, Anna Marie, has always been a supporter of Native American rights and Native American land. And I think that there's probably some Native American heritage in Ronda's family. I bet you if you trace back, you know, her relatives, you could see she definitely has that look to her. And I'd be willing to bet. I don't know that for sure, but I'm willing to bet that. And so it would make sense that Ronda would you know, want to protest this pipeline, and that's a cause that's near and dear to her heart, which is good because I'm all about, you know, fighters supporting social causes, and it's happening more and more now in 2017. It's really, really good. And let's not forget that Ronda actually supported Bernie Sanders during the election. She voiced support for Bernie Sanders during the election, calling Donald Trump a reality TV star. But you know what's interesting about these fighters, about MMA fighters, is that they lack the only MMA fighter that has a coherent political analysis or consistent political belief or beliefs. Actually, there's a few of them. Because many of them are very, very libertarian. Look at someone like Brian Stan. Look at someone like Matt Hughes, Chuck Liddell, Dana White, spoke at the Republican National. These guys are ideologues. They're objectivists. On the other side, you got someone like Jeff Munson. Jeff Munson is a communist. Now, Jeff Munson is an anarchist, actually. I don't even believe he's a communist. I think he's an anarchist. And you know, he could probably explain the difference a lot better than I can. But you know, aside from that, you don't have really coherent political beliefs with MMA fighters. You know, and even fighters that support causes like Ronda and you know, like these guys, Ben Askren and others that support the Mixed Martial Arts Fighters Association, Rob Macy's group, they're all over the place politically. I heard John Fitch yesterday say that he wants smaller government and he wants the market to work, but I voted for Trump. But I'm for the expansion of federal regulation into mixed martial arts, and that's what regulation is. Regulation is law and order. And these guys are socialists. They don't realize it, but they're socialists because they realize that there is a skewed distribution of wealth in MMA, and we could argue the cause of that, but they're for more equal distribution of wealth. And that's one of the principal tenets of socialism. And so they're socialists without realizing, without, you know, if you want to call it, you know, they don't want to call themselves that because that name, being a socialist, has been maligned. And you can't really say that you're a socialist. You can't say it because you'll be branded this, that, and the other thing. And you know, it'll be to your detriment. But that's what they're arguing. That's what Randy Couture is. Now, Randy Couture, oh, Trump supporter, yeah, but I'm for federal regulation. You know, I'm against income inequality when it comes to the UFC. Well, I mean, look, you know, whatever. As long as the end result is equality, as much equality for fighters, then that's great because these fighters are languishing in poverty, ladies and gentlemen. There is absolutely no question about that. No question whatsoever. All right, we got about a half hour here. I haven't heard back from Anthony Hamilton. I'm hoping to hear back from him. He's training, I think, out of Greg Jackson's camp now, and he's got a fight coming up. I wanted to talk to him about against this Marcel Fortana. He was on the Ultimate Fighter 23, Fortana. He's an okay fighter. I mean, he's not anything special. I think Anthony should have the upper hand in that fight. But I wanted to talk to him because, you know, he's a scary fighter, this guy, Anthony Hamilton. But he's someone that he can, you know, if he goes against a jiu-jitsu guy or a ground fighter, then, you know, he has a better shot. But then again, you know, when he fought Francis Ngannou, who's fighting this week, and we'll talk maybe a little bit about that, he was pushing Ngannou around the cage, and Ngannou came out with that ridiculous Kimura that really nobody ever expected. I mean, Jesus, what the hell is that all about? You know, that guy is just freakishly strong. But again, that fight was lost in the first round. If he can get out of the first round, Anthony Hamilton, he is the odds-on favorite to win the fight. And the question is, why is that? You know, so that's what we want to explore. And by the way, he's fighting Marcel Fortana on UFC Fight Night 104, February 4th. So that's actually coming up now. That's actually in less than a week, and we're actually just a little bit, about 10 days or so, 9 days, and we're hoping to get him on the program. And what else we got going on in UFC? We got, or not in UFC, MMA, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry about that. I shouldn't conflate the UFC with MMA. There's a lot going on, a lot of other stuff going on here. I'll tell you about some stuff we got coming up here on Carson's Corner. We're supposed to be interviewing John Peretti. John Peretti is emailed me and wanted to come back on the show. Original matchmaker of the UFC, Gladiator Challenge, creator. Also, what's that reality show he created? The Contenders. John Peretti is a brilliant guy, ladies and gentlemen. He's one of these intellectuals that has been concussed about 15 to 20 times. He's just a beast. He's great. He's one of the best interviewers. And I find it funny that Joe Rogan says that he wants to have John Peretti on the program, and then he doesn't have John Peretti on the program. John Peretti is the most accessible guy that you'll meet, okay? He'll talk to almost anyone. If you want to have John Peretti on your show, you will, Joe Rogan. You're not fooling anybody, Rogan, okay? You're not fooling anybody, pal. Not me. Not anybody. So we're going to have him on probably next, couple weeks or so. I told you last week that we're working on getting some newspaper columns here. I'm still waiting to hear back from them. I can't make any announcements, but it's going to be hopefully very, very soon that we can start to put Carson's Corner on the printing press. Okay, we can give people what they need and start talking about the issues that really, really matter to the masses of Americans, the masses out there. So that's coming up. Really nothing else. I mean, nothing that I could really, really think of at this point. You've got UFC in Denver this week. UFC Fight Night, this the 28th. Very, very excited about this card. A few fights in particular that I want to talk about. And this is a UFC Fight Night 104, UFC 104 Fight Night, featuring Juliana Pena, Angry Pena, who we've dubbed here on Carson's Corner, because I don't care what anybody says, she's angry. And if she loses this fight, which I think it's going to happen, I think she's going to lose this fight. I think Valentina is going to be able to stop her takedowns, and I think she's going to lose this pretty convincingly. In fact, I'm not a betting man, but I got to tell you, I'm close to putting down some money. No, I'm just kidding. I don't bet. I'm not like the UFC brass over there. But what I think is going to happen is she's going to lose this fight, and then she's going to just continue to make excuses. Oh, I wanted to fight. She's just going to continue to run her mouth and get a lot of people that are not liking to it, just not hip to it. You know what I mean? And it's great to have passion, and it's great to really, you know, to feel that you deserve them. But you come across, I think she comes across as entitled and angry, as I said. And that's not something that I'm going to stop calling her. I enjoy calling her Angry Pena, because I think the UFC now, they should really, really capitalize on this. You know, if one of their fighters has a little bit of a personal problem, maybe they should start to highlight that, sort of like they used to do in the old pro wrestling, you know, the Brooklyn Brawler with Steve Lombardi, when he used to smell, his opponents would just, he would come to the ring with the ripped jeans and the ripped shirt on, and he just smelled, and they had so many gimmicks there. The WWE, UFC is moving towards the entertainment route, so why not make light of this or you know, personal problems that the fighters have or with different shortcomings in their personality. So that's my pick. I think Valentina's going to win that fight. I think it's going to be a real decent fight that I'm looking forward to. Because there is that possibility that Juliana can get the takedown, but I just don't see her being as skilled as Valentina is on the striking side of things. And Valentina actually is training with Rose Namajunas right now, and she's working on a bunch of different spinning techniques, working on some grappling. and whatnot. And by the way, you know that Rose Namajunas smokes cigarettes? I didn't know that. I was like shocked. I'm like, oh my God, I couldn't believe that. I can't believe that a professional athlete that competes in mixed martial arts smokes cigarettes. But that's part of like that thug thing that she's into, like the thug life and that series that she does with Pat Barry. So I guess, I don't know, I guess that's part of the thug life there. And I don't know, Valentina lists her training with Tiger Muay Thai, and I thought that she was with Team Alpha Male because I remember not so long ago seeing her in a Team Alpha Male video, sparring, hitting a bag with her sister nearby. But I don't know what the status of that. But that obviously is the main event, and it's good to see women having a main event fight on the UFC fight night. We'll see what the viewership is. Not a lot of buzz for the fight itself, the card, but you've got Cowboy Cerrone versus Jorge Masvidal. And Cowboy Cerrone always puts on exciting fights. This guy is, I can't remember the last time he lost a fight. I think the last time Cowboy lost a fight was to Rafael Dos Anjos. And he's just won, so many fights out there. He's one of the best fighters in 2016. He really, really is. He's coming off of a very, very impressive victory over Matt Brown. And then before that, at welterweight, Rick Story, fill in the blank. And here's a guy that wants to fight really everybody he can, because he says that he wants to fight Damian Maia, unlike Michael Bisping. Doesn't want to fight anybody out there. Donald Cerrone will fight anybody out there. And you got to figure, if he wins this fight, is there a title shot in the making for Donald Cerrone? I would like to see that. I really would. So I'm picking Donald Cerrone to win here. The next intriguing fight on this card is Arlovski and Francis Ngannou. Arlovski, 38 years old, soon to turn 38 years old. He's a guy that has had a long career. Most heavyweights can have longer careers as opposed to, fighters in lower weight classes. I don't know why that is, but it's just the truth. And Francis Ngannou, again, this is going to be a real, real test for him. This is going to answer a lot of questions because, if he blows through Andre Arlovski, I think the UFC will really, really give him a top-ranked fighter out there. Maybe he'll fight a guy like Roy Nelson, or maybe he'll fight the winner of Travis Brown versus Derek Lewis, or you've got Verdum, but Verdum's a little high on the scale there. Just a lot of matchups going on at heavyweight. And Francis Ngannou, who I initially thought was 36 years old, because I had seen him listed at 36. He's actually only 30 years old. Okay. He's a fighter that is from France, sort of like a Czech Congo, almost built like a Czech Congo. But he really, really is a very young guy. He's only 30 years old. And he could be exactly what the heavyweight division needs in MMA. We're going to take a time out here on Carson's Corner. We're going to try to reach out to Anthony Hamilton. We only got about 21 minutes left, so if we can get him on the show, maybe we'll talk about his upcoming fight. That would be great. If not, maybe sometime in the near future. So keep it right here on Carson's Corner on Blog Talk Radio.
I got no soul. Life in prison, no parole, no control. Food, I got my number on a wiretap. Cause I jacked for civil act. Fuck a Cadillac, so fine. One motive, no focus. Every sidewalk I'm off, it's like a tightrope. Yes, I know my deadline, sire. With my life in fire, I'm sending me resentment of the barbed wire. The mother of my John, a loser, my at my grave. It's my life for that life, so call it a free trade. Well, neither am I even born a star. I took a death trip when I tried to cross the white wall.
We're back here on Carson's Corner. I'm Bob Carson, your host. Big thanks to Anthony Hamilton, who's called into the show. Anthony, how are you, my friend?
Hey, man, I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for calling in. We really appreciate it. You're someone we wanted to talk to for a long time now, so let's go right to it. I had some awareness of you as an up-and-coming heavyweight earlier in your career, but, I mean, you really made a name for yourself with, I think, a devastating head kick knockout in MFC over Smilino Rama. And that was one of the most terrifying one-shot KOs MFC ever saw, and they had so many to choose from during the run. Rama, as you know, is a very, very scary fighter in his own right, but the way you took him out was shocking to a lot of people. It's crazy to think that you were almost a 4-1 underdog in that fight, but you seemed to perform well in that position. Before the Rama fight, you were known primarily as a wrestler. And your scary ground-and-pound attack, which we'll get into talking about more in just a moment. But before we talk about your upcoming fight you've got, how did you get into competing in the sport of MMA?
You know, I used to be a wrestler, and after college there wasn't really an outlet for that. And I found some Brazilian jiu-jitsu and started competing in that. And, you know, slowly got into boxing and kickboxing, and it just kind of took off from there. I had my first amateur fight and fell in love with MMA, and the rest was history.
Yeah, I I know that you were you recruited actually due to your size and obvious physical power. I mean, how did you become actively involved with contact sports?
You know, ever since I was a little kid, I just loved sports, and I just tried to compete in every single sport that I could get myself into. And I was a big football player for a long time, and then somebody introduced me to wrestling, and you know, that just made sense, just being a big guy, and I love to mix it up with other guys and be physical, and it just fit the type of person that I am.
How did you make the transition from contact sports to combat sports and MMA? I mean, how did you find out about the sport?
I was doing this jiu-jitsu, and I started seeing guys on the Ultimate Fighter that I wrestled against in college, and I was like, wow, these guys are out there, they're competing, they're making a living off this, they're on TV, and it just was like, man, I can do that, why not me? And so, I slowly started getting into the other forms of martial arts, and like I said, just kind of fell in love with the sport, and it kind of took off. So,
who were some of the guys that you saw on the Ultimate Fighter that you went to college with?
I competed against a guy named Mike Whitehead. I saw him on the Ultimate Fighter in some of the early shows, and he's fought all over. He fought in Strikeforce, fought in UFC, fought in a lot of international promotions and so forth. And so that was a guy that I wrestled against a few different times in college. And so it was him primarily, and then a lot of other guys that I knew just through wrestling, like Corey Hill and mm-hmm. a lot of other wrestlers I saw around the country. And so those guys, and I knew those guys fairly well. And so it just made sense to me.
Yeah, those guys are – Mike Whitehead is definitely a really, really good wrestler, really solid, solid guy. I remember watching him fight many, many times. So you came into the sport, obviously, with the ability to wrestle and overpower people from your background and other disciplines. But the Rama head kick, I think, show that you have diverse striking attack as well when you choose to employ it. And it seems like that time you haven't used a lot of kicking techniques, favoring your hands more. Is that correct? I mean, have you put more of an emphasis on your hands sometimes?
Yeah, I think as of recent, I've kind of fell in love with boxing and kickboxing. And so, for the longest time, I just relied on the wrestling. And, over the years, I've become more and more confident with the striking. And, my team here in Albuquerque, Jackson's MMA, all these guys are great athletes. And, there are a lot of great strikers here. And so, I just figured to myself after a while, if I can hang with these guys, I can hang with anybody. And so it's just slowly come around in the last few years that I've been using more of those techniques.
Yeah, and the Rama kick came in the fourth round of a title fight. I mean, you're a big guy. Did it take a while to get your legs warmed up?
I don't know. I was relying on the wrestling mainly and using a lot of punches to get into the clinch. And, when we came out in the second round, I had knocked a few people out in practice with the head kicks. And I just thought to myself at that moment, like something said to me, throw this kick. And I threw the kick. It landed perfectly and the fight was over. And so is this it was a dream come true that fight really put me on the map, I think, and got me some exposure and changed my life.
You seem like someone who might be even more dangerous in a five-rounder. That's not a thing I find myself saying about too many heavyweights out there. But what is it about your style and fighting skill set that you think enables you to go five rounds? I mean, where we see a lot of other guys your size huffing and puffing after half that long.
Really, it's just being a wrestler, I feel like once you're a real wrestler and a true wrestler, you've done it for years and years and years, there's nothing you can't do. And so just that wrestling mentality, the day-in, day-out grind, I think when I'm in there in the cage or I'm in those situations where, you start to get a little tired or you're getting into the later rounds, you just push through it because that's all I've ever known through wrestling is, you push through the pain, you push through the adversity, and you get the job done.
It seems like a lot of heavyweight fights often end early or end up going the full distance as guys start to tire. Most fighters seem to favor one outcome or the other. And you're somewhat unusual in the sense that you can deliver both a very fast finish or more measured and refined technical performance. Of those two outcomes, Anthony, do you actually have a preference?
you know, I'd like to get in and out of there, you know, just win the fight and have it be in devastated fashion. And, you know, that's what the fans want to see. And, you know, it always feels great to be able to finish a fight. And so, you know, really, I would like to get in and out, but I don't mind, you know, going the distance also, because to me, it's about the journey. And so to be in there and go through one of those bloody battles or something where you just got to push yourself to, you know, the brink of exhaustion or whatever, that's rewarding as well. So, you know, I guess to answer the question, I'd prefer to get in and out, but I don't mind going all around either.
You know, I know it's always easy to get the win as quickly as possible, but going hard for it puts a person in the danger zone, and all heavyweights hit hard. Joe Rogan had some criticism of your striking defense when you fought Olenek, and he said that you were flinching and not always fully aware of what was going on as far as what Olenek was throwing. And obviously, you've always been able to knock fighters out savagely. Is it fair to say that your striking offense progressed more quickly than defense?
Yeah, you know, my defense is I feel, is actually better than my offense. But I think in that particular fight, I was just, you know, that was my first fight in the UFC, and so overcome with emotion just to be in that situation and fighting somebody like Alexi, who was like, you know, 60-plus fight veteran or whatever. I was just, it wasn't like I was even there, man. I was just so, you know, my mind was gone. And so, you know, I definitely accept all those criticisms, man. I mean, it makes sense. But, you know, I do feel like my defense is better than my offense. And my offense has been coming around as of recent. So I could definitely understand what he's saying. But, yeah, I don't know. It was one of those things. You know, it was my first fight in the UFC. And you know, it was a big opportunity against a really tough guy.
You know, looking at your record, what stands out is that you typically win every fight which goes out of the first round. It seems like once you get accustomed to the flow of any individual fight, you make the correct tactical decision and pace yourself in a way that other men of your size struggle with. Is there something in particular that you think lends itself to sometimes getting caught early but otherwise taking over and imposing your will on other fighters?
You know, just like you said earlier, man, in the heavyweight division, everyone can win. Everybody's super strong. They can hit hard or they can impose their will just on size and strength alone. You're right also. I, you know, as we get into the later rounds, I start to settle down and, you know, a lot of these guys get tired. I get tired, but I'm able to push myself through it. And I really start to settle down. The nerves are gone or whatever. And I start to get real comfortable in there. And so I feel great as the fight goes.
You know, you've clearly worked on your ability to defend and survive in a striking battle. I mean, even in a fight like the one you had with Shamil, you showed some definite improvements. And those improvements were also on display when you fought Daniel Emelianchuk, who put on a good beating on Alexei and had him gushing blood all over the cage, but who wasn't able to mount any particular effective offense when you shut him down over three rounds. How different do you feel as a fighter now you've had additional time to develop and round out your game, including defensively? I mean, it seems as if you were at least one step ahead of Daniel and shut everything you attempted to do.
Yeah, I feel great. I think it's just, you know, growing as a fighter and a person and in this sport is, you know, I've matured a lot and I've experienced a lot. And as I get deeper into my career, you know, I feel like I've, you know, there's nothing now that I haven't already seen. And, you know, working with these guys here at Jackson Wink and Albuquerque, I mean, it's just been amazing. I mean, we have, you know, John Jones, Alistair Overeem, you know, Andre Alaska, all these great guys, man, superstars. And so, you know, you don't have a choice but to get better and survive when you're going against guys like this. And so I think that's really helped me, you know, in my development as I continue my MMA career.
Is that where you're at now? Are you in New Mexico now or are you back in Washington?
Yeah, I'm back in New Mexico now. I'm putting the finishing touches on this training, and I'm actually having dinner with Holly Holm and Landon Venata and some other guys from the team. So, yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, you guys definitely seem like you have really, really good camaraderie there And it definitely helps. I mean, a lot of people felt that Ronda Rousey or feel that Ronda Rousey would benefit from training in such an environment there. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, all these people, they come from different backgrounds and they have a different way of looking at fighting. And we all help each other here. We hang out together. We train together. We try to support each other in our fights and, you know, give our opinions and sometimes even criticisms on all of our game. And so, you know, it's great to have these guys in my corner and to be able to spend time with these guys. They're all great athletes and great fighters. And so it's really helped me as I continue my path and going through this sport.
How frustrated have you been with the losses you've experienced after big wins? I mean, they say that heavyweights have longer careers than a lot of fighters at the lower weights. Do you feel any sense of urgency about winning multiple fights in a row, or are you able to accept the learning curve as you you keep improving?
You know, I would like to put together a nice run here. I think it's my time. If I'm going to do it, the time is now. But, you know, I'm just going to leave it up to God on that one and just keep working as hard as I can. Definitely the losses have helped me. They motivate me, they humble me, they keep me hungry, and they enlighten me and tell me exactly what I need to improve on. And so I go back each time and try to get better each time. And so, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the losses that I have experienced thus far. And you know, hopefully I can continue to get better and get on a run here shortly.
How much did you take away from your fight with Francis Ngannou? I mean, he's such a powerhouse and incredibly gifted heavyweight, but it seemed as if you were going to be able to push him around the cage and shut down his striking until he pulled out that Kimura move.
Yeah, I felt great. You know, hats off to Francis, man. Francis, he's a great athlete, and he's going to be an amazing prospect, and I know he's going to, you know, continue to do great things in this sport, but you know, I felt like we had the game plan in place, and I had the tools to beat him. I took him down in the first minute or so, about the first minute or so, and I felt great, you know. But you know, that one mistake that I made, and you know, against a guy at that level and his strength, you know, it was something I can't afford to do. And so, you know, I'm back to the drawing board now. But you know, I was sad about it for about a few weeks, but. In this sport, you gotta have short-term memory, get rid of it, and move on. And so, it was an awesome experience, and hats off to him. But you know, I've made some adjustments, and hopefully those things will pay off.
Well, yeah, you've got a new fight coming up against Marcel Fortana. He's not somebody I know a lot about. I know he was on The Ultimate Fighter. He's primarily a grappler. He has a page on BJJHeroes.com, so he has to be pretty good on the ground, but. From what I've seen, he looks like a light heavyweight. I mean, he doesn't look like, you know, someone that has your size, and he looks like he would have difficulty fighting someone, you know, as powerful as you are. He hasn't fought for about 18 months, and you know, he's listed as 6'1", but it seems like he's going to be facing a significant size and strength advantage. So, what do you take away from? You know, watching, or have you seen footage of him yet?
Yeah, I've seen a few videos. I watched a little bit of video today with Coach Wink, and you know, Marcel's a tough athlete, very experienced grappler, like you said, and you know, none of these fights in the UFC are easy, and so just for him to be there, I think says a lot. You know, he's a tough guy, and it's not going to be an easy fight by any means. I am bigger, I am going to be a lot stronger than him, but you know, at this level, it's not going to matter much. I mean, anybody can still win. So I have my hands full next week, but I'll be prepared and I'll be ready to go, and hopefully we'll get the win.
Yeah, this seems like a real strange fight on paper. Do you have any indication of why Fortana is going up to challenge you at heavyweight? I mean, someone as powerful as yourself?
Not quite sure. Him being a light heavyweight, I think for the majority of his career, you know, maybe these last 18 months he's put on some muscle or something. You know, who knows? But you know, nonetheless, it's an opportunity for both of us. It's an opportunity for him to get into the UFC, and it's an opportunity for me to start my run. So, you know, I'm not going to look into it too much, but you know, he's still going to be tough, and I need to be ready to go.
Yeah, I give him respect for getting in there with you for his UFC debut. I mean, there's so much that could go wrong for even a high-level grappler when someone with your finishing ability, size, and strength is staring at him across the cage. I mean, he's a Hal Gracie student, so you'd expect nothing less from him. You know, it's really, really something. Do you have any prediction for this fight, Anthony? What do you think the folks at home should expect seeing this fight?
Oh, I think it's going to be a great fight. You know, I know Marcel, he's coming in here to win. I'm sure he's prepared and he's ready to go. I don't think he would take the fight if he wasn't. And I know that I'm ready to go. I haven't stopped training since, summertime. So, you know, I feel ready. I feel confident. I think it's going to be an amazing fight for the fans. And we're going to put on a great show next week in Houston. And I think everybody should tune in and check it out. But as far as predictions are concerned, you know, I'm not quite sure. I think I definitely have the ability to finish him in any of the rounds, but it won't be easy. And so I need to make sure that I'm focused and ready to work hard. And if I can do that, I definitely will get the job done.
Not to look past Fertitta, but do you have any hypothetical thoughts about fighters in the division you'd like to test yourself against to try and build that momentum we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, you know, there's a few guys out there that I have my eye on, but I need to get past Fortuna first, and, you know, he's not going to be an easy opponent. But, you know, I would love to beat up some of these other guys, the Surreal Askers or, you know, the Jarvis Danhos or the Christian Colombos of the fight game. I think any three of those guys would be great opponents for me and help continue to build my way and climb this ladder.
Well, listen, Anthony, thank you so much. I need to let you get back to training for your big fight in Houston on February 4th in just 9 or so days. Let's tell people at home how they can keep up with you on social media and mention anything else we neglected to during our interview here.
Oh, yeah, no worries. You can catch me on Twitter at @ahamilton_MMA. Also, you can catch me on Instagram at @ahamilton_MMA. And you can catch me on Facebook at Anthony Freight Train Hamilton. And I hope that all you guys can catch the fight next week in Houston. I think the card's going to be unbelievable, and we're going to put on a great show.
Absolutely, I'm sure of it. Thank you so much, Anthony. Take care, my friend. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. You take care as well.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right, folks, that was Anthony Hamilton. And you know what? Scott Zurer said it himself, said that Anthony Hamilton is one of the nicest guys. We really appreciate him taking time to allow us to interview him. Such a short notice between now and his fight coming up, and we really, really appreciate it. And Holly's got a fight, too. Yeah, Holly's going to be on – well, no, Holly has the UFC 208 pay-per-view in Brooklyn at the Barclays Center. I think Holly's going to be the favorite for that fight. And so you got to – as I said, positive energy there. Good camaraderie between the folks over at the Jackson Winklejohn team there in Albuquerque, New Mexico. All right, let me tell you how you could friend me. You could friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/ BobCarsonMMA. Make sure to catch Carson's Corner each week here on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. And if you're interested in radical politics, make sure to tune in and listen to my political show here, Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates, Monday from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. So thank you so much to Anthony Hamilton. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.